This second experiment is the laser reflector.
Vacuum flashing.
Fringe element of science. It's more in terms of holes and looking for patterns of connections, networks.
We found that getting them down produced no significant problems.
Series of important observations to artificially reproduce the light of the aurora and to present science with a summary of new and incontestable facts.
Or to opening ourselves to phenomena that don't fit into our preconceived notions.
Welcome back to part two of the Solari Future Science report on nanotechnology. Today we will go a step further and we will explore the field implications of bio-nanotechnology. I know we are often influenced by images of little robots running through our veins, and there is somewhat of a thrilling shiver that runs down our spines. Today, however, I would like to take this to a subtler area and one that we may overlook by focusing on the machine idea of nanobots. The wave genome points us to the immaterial, an interaction with information fields in space and time, rather than a purely material reality. This has been the secret of life so far, and it was and is difficult to crack for the purely materialist scientist. However, due to the unique position of the nanoscale along the logarithmic line of universal lengths, scientists are bound to discover some of the information field design of life. And we too should know about this, for we all have a role to play in protecting the sanctity of life from its utilization by what would be called an Ahrimanic mechanistic power that tries to pull a veil of matter or a web of sensors over the mind and replace or curb our innate, dynamic, and co-creative interaction with the living. Most of what we discussed in part one, and particularly regarding the applications of medical nanotechnology, concerned the interfacing of biology or living matter with micro-robotics, computer engineering, and a resultant programmable matter. Remember that biology and bioengineering is essentially the same as nanotechnology. Both happen on the same scale. And on this tiny nanoscale, a phase shift occurs, probably more profound than the one on the quantum scale. It is here that the transition between macro and micro reality, between particle and wave structure, is beginning to take hold and show effects. That is why this area of research is going to so profoundly impact our lives. It is the phase transition between matter and information. Therefore, information technology and biotechnology or bioinformatics are converging on this level into an inevitable bio-digital convergence that even governments are speaking about and projecting into the no longer distant future. You will find a very good report by James Corbett on exactly this biodigital convergence, which I would like to recommend to each of you. The fusion of our understanding of biology with nanotechnology is subsumed under the general term synthetic biology. And this comprises a mixture of technological engineering and genetic or biomolecular engineering in order to create enhanced or altogether new organisms. Many different concepts and disciplines are subsumed under synthetic biology, such as digital biology, claytronics, programmable matter, xenobiology, etc. All of them are used for various applications, resulting primarily in biological computing. This biological computing has led to the creation of new and artificial life forms. The very first synthetic organism in modern day period is Craig Venter's Cynthia 1 and subsequent Cynthia 3, an artificial bacterial life form. What was done is that Mycoplasma genitalium, which is an infectious bacterium, was emptied of its chromosomes and was inserted with a new, totally artificial genome that also contained four watermarks or owner's tags with the names of the scientists that created the genome, including that of Craig Venter. It also included a website address and three quotes from literature, human history, that the authors chose to represent their mindset in making this synthetic biology. So here we see the artificial genome. This was published in 2010. And here are the four watermarks or the inserts that look like these in genetic letters. These would correspond to the four inserts. And these four inserts are not any functional proteins, but are there as code of human information in the bacterial life form. When these four inserts are discovered and deciphered, they reveal three quotes that are demonstrating that this is genuinely an artificial life form, the world's first synthetic life. These are the four quotes: to live, to err, to fall, to triumph, to recreate life out of life, by James Joyce. The second quote is see things not as they are, but as they might be. It's attributed to J. Robert Oppenheimer. And the third quote, what I cannot build, I cannot understand, attributed to Richard Feynman, coded in code of genetics into a bacterium. This creation of synthetic genomes is possible due to a digitalization of biology and, reversely, an emergent biology from digital data. Here again, we see that convergence. The scientists write the genome code on the computer and then assemble the corresponding nucleotides, like letters, into a text. In the same way, the names of these authors and quotes were made into biological information. So here, in this case, they were not using CRISPR to add or remove genes, but they wrote an entire genome code from scratch. We see that DNA can be utilized to store information, which is information that is not necessarily biological information or a protein script, but any information, such as a name or a text, or as we will see, even a video can be stored in DNA. More and more DNA is used for such data storage. And Harvard Medical School is among the key institutions to pursue this development. They are finding that DNA is highly dense, a million times more dense than any other storage media. So 1 gram of DNA can store hundreds of petabytes of data. That's trillions of bytes of data. And also, one advantage of DNA storage and ultimately DNA computing is that there is an in-storage computing, meaning you do not have 2 separate places, one for where you keep the data and the other where the processing is going on, but processing and data storage are on the same level. In the following, a short video excerpt from a talk by a Harvard Medical School professor who is working on DNA information storage.
How we might use nucleic acids to store data. What is data and what is the cloud? This is a photo of the Facebook data center. It's about 1 million square meters, about $1 billion to construct, and it holds all of your data. Yet 90% of the data is never accessed. This is what we have learned from Facebook, from Dropbox, and from a number of studies. By using storage at this rate, by 2025, we'll run into at least 2 problems. There will be more data generated than the amount of silicon that can be used for memory being mined. And second, data centers will take about 20% of the global world electricity production. So clearly, we need to do something else. DNA is incredibly dense, it's easy to replicate, and it's something that we will read forever as long as we have access to a DNA sequencer. The world's largest, most advanced USB drives store about 1 terabyte of storage. Now, if you take the calculation of how much DNA is in your biological thumb, you can get 100 million times that storage, and that's something that we can read at any point.
So that's quite interesting how much data can be stored in just a tiny little bit of DNA. And here's the work of 2 European inventors who received this year's European Innovation Prize for making DNA storage stable, because this is one of the questions of how to stabilize the storage into something that is as sensitive as DNA. Here's Robert Grass and Wendelin Stark from Austria and Switzerland. They are working with an advanced form of data storage in DNA that is permanently protected in form of synthetic fossils. As we will see in the next video excerpt, the information from a book is converted into DNA letters and then synthesized as DNA. In order to make the storage long-lasting, the DNA is placed into tiny glass beads, much like an amber fossil encapsulating an ancient insect.
So the researchers take nature and combine it with technology. For example, every character in a book can be translated into digital code, and that, in turn, into a DNA code. A sequence of DNA letters is created. This construction plan then enables artificial DNA to be produced. And the information inside an entire book can then become DNA. But protecting it effectively is a challenge. The problem with all of the previous approaches was that the information wasn't stable enough if simply translated into DNA. The stability doesn't only depend on the DNA itself, but also on sealing the DNA inside another material. Finally, they try using tiny spheres of non-porous silicon dioxide, that is, glass particles. These are only 1/10,000th of a millimeter in size, and so they're only visible under an electron microscope. The researchers seal the DNA inside these tiny spheres. There's enough DNA in each one to store 2 pages of a book. The problem is that we can't read the DNA when it's inside the glass particles, so we have to remove it. With glass, we chose the most stable material in existence. But there are fluoride ions, and they react with glass, so we can selectively dissolve the glass without destroying the DNA. Using these biotechnological methods, the researchers succeed in retrieving the valuable data from the tiny glass beads. After 3 years of intensive research, it's now clear. The DNA data stored inside the synthetic glass fossils is undamaged. The DNA code can be read in its entirety again and translated back into the original information. The researchers even use this technique to preserve a music album for eternity.
Quite remarkable how precise DNA is storing normal information once it is digitized. But not only human letters to DNA letter translations are possible, all digital data can be stored in DNA. And here we see how scientists already in 2017 have stored a video in DNA, bacterial DNA, and were able to recapture it. These are scientists at Harvard under George Church. They used CRISPR DNA editing technology to record images first of a human hand into the genome of a living E. coli bacteria. And this then was read out with higher than 90% accuracy. The bacteria were able to pass this DNA information on to following generations. Later, a full video with a horse movement, which employs a sequence, namely a time factor of data, was again retrieved in the same way. The method is termed molecular recording and is of far-reaching implications for the recording of time, of biological time. And we will see that this plays a role in our discussion today. Here we see a short edited video.
So we're looking at an image of a human hand. We chose a human hand because it was one of the first images that people put onto the natural world. And so since we were encoding images here into the natural world in a different way, we decided to recapitulate one of those images. And what you're seeing is the source image, which is what we started with. We then encoded all of the pixel values into the nucleotides of DNA, distributed them over a number of strands of DNA, and then put them into bacteria, where the bacteria acquired those sequences and captured them into their own genome. After the cells grew for a while, we then sequenced their genomes and were able to reconstruct the image based on the sequencing of the nucleotides that were inserted. And so then what you're looking at is also the reconstructed image from the bacteria after they were sequenced. Here we are looking at an image of a horse or a movie of a horse running. This was originally taken by Edward Muybridge. Again, it was one of the first moving images that was made. And so we thought that was an appropriate thing to encode. And what we did here was, again, for each frame, break down the pixel values and encode them in the nucleotides of DNA across many different strands, about 100 strands for each frame of the image. And then in this case, we delivered those strands to living bacteria over time. So each frame was delivered on a different day over the course of 5 days. And then, we let those cells grow for a little while, and then we sequenced their genomes, and we were able to reconstruct not only each of the frames, but the order of each of the frames, because the molecular recording system that we're using captures the timing information of different molecular events. The next step would be to hook it up to actual biology, right? So right now, we were supplying information in the form of synthesized DNA. In the future, we want that information to come from biological events that are happening within the cell. So that's the next step.
So that is fairly interesting. I hope you caught that at the very end. The molecular recording is able to capture the timing information of molecular events. And the scientists are looking not just at recording time sequences that are coming in from external information, but are ultimately interested in recording the time sequence of molecular events in the cell. This is the decoding of biological time, and it will take us to the larger umbrella of today's talk, epigenetics. And it is there that I feel that the biggest breakthroughs in nanotechnology are being made, which will concern us. So he said, in the future, we want this to record the events of the cell itself. It is therefore reading a time sequence that is of events going on inside. The method of molecular recording is more than meets the eye at first. It says in this article of only 2019, so this is all cutting edge and very, very recent research. Here we present a flexible, high information, multi-channel molecular recorder with a single cell readout and apply it as an evolving lineage tracer to assemble mouse cell fate maps from fertilization through gastrulation. So the cells of mouse tissue, their fates, their timeline, their life history is mapped out over a stretch of time. And this is done with high information and multi-channel molecules are being read. Our approach, it says also, enables massively parallel high-resolution recording of lineage and other information in mammalian systems. So what we are looking at is the recording of time in our cells. Now, this refers to our own historical time, but even to lineage time, to predecessors that are going into our own genetic code. Also, DNA or biomolecules are more and more used for biocomputing, which will then allow for massive parallel computing at very low energy costs. Normal computers cannot do parallel functions at all. It may seem that our PC or smartphone can perform several tasks at once, but really it can only do one logical step at a time. It does this, however, very, very quickly in modern CPUs, about 2.5 billion times per second, it can switch between different steps. And as mentioned in part one, there are first bio nanotransistors or such on-off switches using enzymes in cells and along the DNA. So we are beginning to use DNA and cells as biological, literally biological processes. There are attempts at drawing whole integrated circuits with proteins and biomolecules that are leading us to completely new forms of computation. Here in this work, we see nanometer-sized biomolecular machines that can solve problems by moving through a nano-fabricated network of channels that are designed to represent a mathematical problem. So this is the network of channels that is designed, and the result as they move through will then be the solution to a mathematical problem. What is moving through is biomolecular machines. They are called myosin. Despite that the biological proteins are moving rather slowly in comparison to current computer speeds, what the advantage is that proteins and biomolecules are self-assembling, and they can be used in large numbers and can quickly add up their computing power into parallel computations. It tells us a given combinatorial problem is encoded into a graphical modular network that is embedded in a nanofabricated planar device. Exploring the network in a parallel fashion using a large number of independent molecular motor-propelled agents then solves the mathematical problem and does this very quickly. So in 2016, this is the first viable biocomputer using this biomolecule myosin for solving problems. Myosin are proteins that we all have in our bodies. They allow for muscle contraction. They transport a motor or they transport a signal or a protein in the muscle fiber. And these myosin motors move the filaments along certain paths, which paths can be designed artificially in order to produce this calculation network. Again, let us look at a short video excerpt to explain this.
Classical computers can't do such things very well. The closest thing that we've gotten to is many classical computers slapped together and given the title of a supercomputer. What we need is a computer that can actually solve many problems at the same time. What we need is something called a parallel computer. A brand new feasible solution has just been discovered at Lund University in Sweden. The results have been published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. The biocomputing approach uses less than 1% of the energy used by current electronic transistors. As it turns out, the solution has been around for a very long time in the form of a protein called myosin, part of our muscle tissue. You're actually using myosin right now in your eyes to watch this video. Myosin can be thought of as tiny molecular motors converting chemical energy into mechanical energy. The Swedish biocomputer uses the myosin to guide protein filaments along artificial paths. In simple terms, it involves building a network of nano-based channels that give specific traffic regulations for protein filaments. The solution in the network corresponds to the answer of a mathematical question, and many molecules can find their way through the network at the same time. Let's quickly look at the system in action. You're looking at it right now. The numbers at the bottom represent solved solutions to an equation. As you can see, the system is finding many solutions at the same time.
So you will soon have bacteria or bioproteins in your smartphone and tablet. And you will have life's molecules, DNA and RNA, harnessed into computer operations. Simple life forms such as bacteria and cells at large are being employed as logical gates and calculators, or even as power generators for cryptocurrencies mining and for the blockchain, such as in this institute in the Netherlands, where organisms, in this case human organisms, are utilized for energy production. All this as part of the biodigital convergence and synthetic biology that have come as a consequence of the interfacing of life and machine. The biorobots, however, that I consider as much more groundbreaking and the knowledge of which is much more impactful than what we have seen so far, in my opinion, are those that are created by the manipulation of nothing less than the electric energy information field of the living species. Harvard now knows the biofield. The same institutions that study how to interweave brains with computers now know how to control the morphogenetic field of a species. They have solved one of the long-standing unanswered questions of biology and genetics, namely, what is the guiding force behind cell differentiation? If all cells essentially have the same chromosomal library, how and when do they decide to differentiate into very differently structured and functional cells from the same stem cell, blastula? Where is the information stored if not in the genes alone? The Harvard scientists were, of course, not the first or the only ones to discover this guiding electric field that steers cell differentiation at the anatomical spatial order of the organism. But most of the former discoveries were regarded as fringe or as more or less unscientific. However, once a university like Harvard and Tufts are working with the energy field of living creatures, the results take on a new direction and potential. As you have seen in the recommended TED Talk by the distinguished professor of biology at Tufts University, Dr. Michael Levin, he works on the electrical voltage differences across the cells in a developing animal to influence gene expression or to correct birth defects or to regenerate whole limbs or even to grow additional limbs. And he does this all without making any changes to the DNA molecule, only by controlling the electrical field that surrounds the cells. DNA is not the only aspect to build and regulate an organism. The effects of the electrical direct current potentials covering the organism are what define the function and location in space and time for the life form. It is now possible to intervene in this bioelectrical code without the need to intervene with DNA. Here's an excerpt of the TED Talk by Michael Levin, and he explains that this electromagnetic or electric field around the cells and how this is the guiding force for cell differentiation.
Well, cells certainly do communicate biochemically and via physical forces, but there's something else that's going on that's extremely interesting. And that is that it's basically called bioelectricity, non-neural bioelectricity. So it turns out that all cells, not just nerves, but all cells in your body communicate with each other using electrical signals. And what you're seeing here is a time-lapse video for the first time. We are now able to eavesdrop on all of the electrical conversations that the cells are having with each other. So think about this. We're now watching. This is an early frog embryo. This is about 8 hours to 10 hours of development. And the colors are showing you actual electrical states that allows you to see all of the electrical software that's running on the genome-defined cellular hardware. And so these cells are basically communicating with each other, who's going to be head, who's going to be tail, who's going to be left and right and make eyes and brain and so on. And so it is this software that allows these living systems to achieve specific goals, goals such as building an embryo or regenerating a limb for animals that do this. And the ability to see these electrical conversations gives us some really remarkable opportunities to target or to rewrite the goals towards which these living systems are operating.
Now, this is groundbreaking research, but they are not the first. In the 1960s and 70s, earlier work by Robert O. Becker, author of the well-known book, The Body Electric, showed already that by applying an electrical potential to the location of a severed limb in animals, certain species could regrow a full limb, or others, especially mammals, at least were able to regrow a partial limb. It is now understood that there is a direct current associated with the central nervous system, and more precisely with the glia cells covering the nerves as a sheath. In these cells, it seems that the direct current potential is flowing or is situated. So this is the research of Robert O. Becker, and we must understand that salamanders have the natural ability of limb regenerations, while other animals, such as frogs, for example, do not have this. When a salamander's leg gets cut off, it is able to regrow the leg completely. However, when to a frog where the leg is cut off, or here a mammal, a mouse or a rat, when a limb is cut off and a direct current field is applied, also the rat or also the frog will grow its limb again. We see the different stages. Here is the cutting off and then the regrowing of the limb. This is in the case of the salamander, the natural regeneration. Here we see the rat having its limb severed, and then the direct current is being applied. After 7 days, there will be the beginning of the growing of new muscle, new nerves, and even new bone structures. Interestingly, most organisms have the same direct current or electric field polarization along the nervous system. We also remember from the wave genome the unique results of Guido Ebner and Heinz Schürch of Novartis in Switzerland. They treated the spawn of trout or the spores of fern and other plants in an electrostatic field to discover that antecedent phenotypes and morphologies emerged from these eggs or from these spores, even though the genome had not been touched. And we also remember the work of Tian Kanchen, who was able to electromagnetically create hybrid features between chicken and duck as well as between cucumber and melons and other species. No gene splicing, no CRISPR technology. All that is done is the radiation of the field. Now, the work done in Michael Levin's group is a revival and a profound expansion upon these earlier findings. And once again, since this is now done at a major, major university that is interested in the interface between human and machine, that is interested in biorobotics, that is interested in bio-nanotechnology, there is something special happening in the knowledge field of academia. So Michael Levin has found that each organ and each organism has an electrical pattern that can be controlled by switching voltage-gated ion channels in the cells on or off, almost like transistors. They are not applying, in this case, electricity per se. They are switching the ion channels between the cells. And this electrical map that runs upon all the cells by switching on and off can be manipulated to build different structures than the cells would normally build. We quote, "We are now beginning to crack that morphogenetic code and rewrite that map to new outcomes." These planaria worms, hopefully you've seen the TED Talk, have the ability to regenerate themselves almost from any section cut off, similar to the salamander, but even more powerful. And they will always build a full planaria. The Levin lab has changed the electrical field, once again, by switching the ion channel transistors, and has been able to generate planaria with two heads or with two tails. Similarly, they are able to regenerate limbs in other animals, or to even grow extra limbs. It can grow extra organs or extra eyes simply by manipulating the field. This is groundbreaking, as there is no CRISPR editing of the genome required. The DNA remains the same, and yet unheard of changes are made. Remember also, in the concept of the wave genome, the DNA-RNA double helix is primarily acting as an antenna that captures and transmits the yet-to-be-discovered informational fields, which hold the key to the morphological maps, including the neurological electrical maps. In further research, the Levin lab is also looking at the cognitive or consciousness aspect of morphogenesis. The question is, does shape have something to do with cognition, with brain functions, with consciousness? How does shape emerge? How does consciousness emerge? Is there information in the voltage patterns along the nervous system? Can we simply manipulate the cell or the body without impacting on its inherent and emergent consciousness? Levin's work was also able to restore brain function simply by the manipulation of the voltage field of the cells. It is possible to repair damaged brains during embryogenesis and in later stages by guiding or controlling the bioelectric circuits. In this case, nicotine was used to disrupt the normal electrical patterns in the brain of the growing embryo. And what emerged was a misguided or misformed brain. This is a normal brain of the frog embryo. And here we have, under the influence of nicotine during embryogenesis, nicotine reduces the strengths of the voltage map. It's no longer clearly defined. And this leads to malformations and malfunctioning of the nervous system. The authors then activated the ion channels and returned the functionality of the brain even when the ion channels were activated not in the region of the central nervous system. Again, let us remember how close Tufts is to Harvard and to the Lieber research on brain-machine interfaces. Will these interfaces be possible eventually by altering and controlling the ion channel gates of the cells to stimulate new electrical patterns over and across the neurological network? Their most recent work applies this understanding to create robotic life forms, xenobots, they call them, by designing a computer platform to select the appropriate shape and function. Xenobots have emergent consciousness. They represent a form of synthetic morphogenesis. They can be called living machines because they are not a life form, but they still have a type of will of their own. And they can be programmed to perform certain functions. For the production of these xenobots, the researchers selected skin cells and heart cells from the African frog and combined them in a particular way in order to produce an entity that can walk. Here we have the skin cells in green and the heart cells in red. The heart cells were placed in particular locations because they would then enable the organism to move, to propel itself forward through the contraction motion of the heart cells. They're displaying almost will behavior, or they seem to be at least, having a will, a social life, a certain interaction and certain activity. Here we have a description of how this has been done. Stem cells were opened, stem, and the tissue is harvested, which then forms into a sphere. And this tissue, the sphere, closes in upon itself and becomes mobile. It moves by little cilia, small hair that it developed on its surface without the researchers telling it to do so. It also seems to be able to move upon its own. They also have a rudimentary type of memory and can be programmed to make signals under certain environmental conditions. Researchers believe that they will be able to use them as robots to clean up certain areas. They heal when injured. Now, the important insight in all of this work is that it is not primarily the molecular chemical genome that is involved in the pattern formation, in the pattern memory, in the morphogenesis. Genetically, no change has been made, but proteins, enzymes, and processes were either expressed or switched off through other factors, which demonstrates the superior information field on the epigenetic level. Epigenetics is a study of the causes for the different phenotypes without changing the genotype, or how non-gene factors can influence the traits and functions of an organism. How and why is a gene expressed or not? What factors from the environment, and environment in the widest sense, including the electromagnetic field environment, information environment, may impact gene expression, the turning on and off of certain genes, acting as a switch for different genomic sequences? The genome is the instructions, while the epigenome is how they are read. We can see this very markedly in the example of the honeybee. Each of these manifestations of the bee have almost the same genome, the worker bee, the drone, and the queen, and yet they form completely different functions and phenotypes. These factors that decide upon the epigenetic expression are, for example, the food that the queen bee receives, or a certain probably electromagnetic communication that is going on to decide which function the entity will take on in the swarm organism. Epigenetics is explaining a wide variety of factors in the expression of life. Think of twins who have the same genome, but who lead very different lives and may have very different reactions to the environment. A wide variety of illnesses, behaviors, and other health indicators have already been linked in the past with epigenetic mechanisms. For example, almost all types of cancers, but also cognitive dysfunctions. Schizophrenia has been connected with epigenetic markers, and other mental or neurological diseases, but also respiratory, cardiovascular, reproductive, and autoimmune diseases. The known or suspected drivers behind epigenetic processes are manifold, including poisoning through heavy metals, pesticides, diesel exhaust and other exhaust particles, tobacco smoke, as well as hormones, radioactivity, microwave radiation, but also viruses, bacteria, and in fact also mentality, habit, medical procedures or stress or family situation, emotional environment, etc. All of this is part of the epigenetic coding of the organism. In this sense, we can imagine how the modern RNA and DNA vaccines are going to be epigenetic interventions. They will have not only a genetic effect, but an epigenetic effect, an impact on the way genes are expressed and proteins are synthesized. Epigenetic factors can be found or are visible along the DNA in form of especially two aspects, namely DNA methylation, that is the addition or the removal of a methyl group, which acts as a marker. Each of these methyl groups, as it is added to the chromosome or to the DNA helix at a certain point, corresponds with an event that left an epigenetic trace in the life of the organism. And usually methyl markers along the DNA helix mean that the particular region in the DNA is no longer going to be expressed or is expressed in a faulty manner. Another form of epigenomic changes are chromatin modifications. Chromatin is the winding up of the double helix to ultimately form the chromosome. In order to do this winding up, the double helix winds or folds around proteins that are called histones. If there are epigenetic markers on the histone tails, epigenetic factors, the folding and winding as well as unwinding is hampered, is no longer smooth. What is most interesting is that these methyl groups and epigenetic factors on the histones function like a timeline of environmental and inter-environmental events. So these also show when the events occurred in the lifetime of an organism. So what we are seeing through the work of Becker or also of Gayaev or people, modern researchers such as Bruce Lipton, and now in particular through the work of Michael Levin and his laboratory, is that epigenetics relates to the informational field that plays a role in the expression or manifestation of the organism. The epigenetic literally is interconnected with the electromagnetic and informational field. There seems to be an epigenetic information flow within the voltage gradients across the organism that Michael Levin discovered. And if that is altered, will result in more or less dramatic changes of the space and the morphology that is incorporated by the life form. This leads us to the question, is there a deeper significance in the actual shape or space of an organism? Is there meaning in the harmonics and proportions in the geometry of the body and the resultant communication and memory flows between the cells so positioned? We should think about this. Where does the spatial and temporal structure of the human body, its manifestation, in space and time result from? It is obviously not the DNA alone. And the question is, with these breakthroughs now made in the last couple of years, is science at the brink of understanding and addressing the geometry of shape in living bodies? Michael Levin can create different shapes. What is the feedback to the intelligence of the organism? What is the feedback between space and time and the life force in the body? Here we see how close, through net advances in genetic engineering, we have come to cross the threshold between the material and the immaterial. And if we understand that there is a meaning in the shape, the geometry, the spatial manifestation of an organism, what does this mean for the building of an internet of bodies and the new development of spatial computing? Spatial computing is one of the developments riding upon the nanotechnological and biodigital convergence. Spatial computing is the use of three-dimensional physical space to interface with a computer and to receive computer output. So it is no longer a flat computer or a keyboard and a flat screen, a device, but it is literally the digitalization of the environment, of the space around us. And I would argue not only the surface space around us, but the actual nature of space. Spatial computing is the human interaction with machines such as computers, robots, or sensors that can save and manipulate data and relations of data on real objects and 3D spaces. The new web or internet, the spatial web, will give us 3D input and three-dimensional output. And for that, one needs a special internet protocol upon which different companies and players are working. Normal HTTP will not power the full spatial web. The internet, the web, will need to be re-envisioned into a spatial web. So far, the World Wide Web is still a flat interconnection of different computers, different servers, and nodes. The spatial web will take this into three-dimensional protocols, will take this into the interaction and interrelationship of spaces and computers, and as it says, people. The following company has developed what they are calling a hyperspace transfer protocol to be able to calculate the spatial web. Here is a short film excerpt. All of the videos, by the way, are edited. You will find the linkage to in the bibliography.
There's a new world emerging right before our very eyes. A world where we seamlessly and naturally interact with augmented and virtual reality, opening endless possibilities to learn, collaborate, create, and explore. Where spaces and cities become smart, physical and digital goods are tracked, and people's identity, security, and finances are protected. enabling citizens, big data, artificial intelligence, and the Internet of Things to finally work together for the benefit of humanity and the planet. But have you ever stopped and wondered, how do we actually get from here to there? The last few years have shown enormous advances in augmented and virtual reality devices, computer vision, location tracking, edge computing, blockchain, and 5G. But these applications and the devices and operating systems they utilize are not connected. They're siloed experiences. There's no common standard for how all these technologies and applications can work together. For that, you need a common protocol, a way to communicate between each of these technologies. And for that, you need Versus. Versus has developed the HSTP, or Hyperspace Transfer Protocol, allowing parties to agree on who, what, and where everything is in physical and virtual worlds. Join us and our many forward-thinking partners and industry leaders as we drive the next generation of innovation and lay down the digital infrastructure to support a better future and a new web for people, businesses, our environment, and humanity. Let's build the spatial web.
Now, put this together with the hacking of the energy field, the spatial field, or the space geometry of organisms. After 5G, as the Internet of Things, we will have 6G already announced as the Internet of Bodies, where each one will wear or carry sensors and computers that link us to each other and to the cloud. With the new breakthrough, will we have a 7G, an Internet of Energy Bodies, that is an internet that controls and programs the shaping electrical fields of all life. Maybe this sounds far-fetched, but I think we should think ahead into possible developments. But it is not only space that is being hacked or that is now in the reach of science. More importantly, when we look at the epigenetic markers along the line of the double helix, such as the methyl groups and the histone tails, they virtually construct a timeline of epigenetic molecular events, and thus a timeline of the environmental impacts and changes that can act as identifiers for the marked events in the life of an organism. Remember the molecular recorder that is intending to read the time of events in the cell. It would utilize epigenetic time markers. The markers along the epigenome, you can actually think of as entries in the diary of life. And wouldn't it be interesting and provide insight and intelligence if one can look into somebody's book of life? Now, the military is doing just that. DARPA's ECHO program stands for Epigenetic Characterization and Observation. Epigenetic Characterization and Observation. Quote, ECHO aims to develop technologies that enable the use of an individual's epigenome to reveal their history of exposure to weapons of mass destruction and their precursors. Now, of course, in a military context, you have to give it a military function or some war scenario function. But what it does is revealing an individual's history of exposure. Weapons of mass destruction sounds very specialized, but the exposure can be equally to any other agent of life, any other impact or influence that would register in the epigenome. And we have already seen that all kinds of impacts, even emotional impacts, consciousness impacts, diseases, nicotine, alcohol, food, all leave their epigenetic markers. So what lies before the researchers is an actual timeline of events of an organism's life history. This could include the time of drug use or the times of exposure to viruses, the time of exposure to radiation, even the time or moments of psychological trauma, the time of conception and pregnancy, the epigenetic marker even of when you met your spouse or how you were treated by your father. ECHO, it says, is a technology that quickly reads someone's epigenome and identifies signatures that indicate whether that person has ever, in his or her lifetime, been exposed to whatever is defined or looked for. And so this program by DARPA, ECHO, is combined with other programs, such as the PREPARE program and others, also to work in the current pandemic, and is designed to diagnose or sense or discover exposure to not only chemical weapons, but also biological, viral weapons, if you will, or any other event. Interestingly, in the brochure that DARPA published on preventing pandemics, where ECHO is being referenced, also other programs are referenced, showing how the company Moderna was asked by DARPA already in 2017 to work on RNA vaccines. And in partnership with prevention, diagnosis is a critical aspect of pandemic response. Rapid discovery, validation, and manufacture of diagnostic tools that the public health community can use to detect any disease threat anytime, anywhere, is the raison d'être for two DARPA programs. The one detected with gene editing technologies, DIGIT, and the epigenetic characterization and observation, or ECHO. So these programs are utilized in global situations, but they build on an understanding of the epigenetic field that travels with the genetic code, that travels with the electromagnetic biofield, and this biofield can now be manipulated. If we, instead of exposure to weapons of mass destruction or viruses, substitute the word experience, then we can read an individual's characteristic life experiences, even from a sample of their saliva or of their blood. The head of the DARPA program, the ECHO program, Dr. Eric van Giessen, says the epigenome is biology's record keeper. We are just beginning to understand this rich biographical record that we carry around with us. The same technology also is aiming to predict outcomes from exposure or experience. So you're looking at the full timeline of past, present, and future of an organism's critical life events. This not only gives access to an individual's lifetime, but ultimately can serve also as bodies or organisms being used as sensors over time, recording and predicting certain environmental factors. Eric von Giesen says, it turns out our bodies or any biological organism are better sensors than anything we can build synthetically to date. For example, we've realized that our body's reaction to an infection happens 2 or 3 days before one can even detect a pathogen. So why not use our own body for early detection based on the reading of the epigenome? So this has been applied during the current pandemic, and they find that their diagnosis and sensing device based on saliva and blood tests reading the epigenetic information is more sensitive and more precise than the PCR tests that are taken everywhere. Of course, we know that the PCR tests are not precise for detecting a virus. But please listen to an excerpt of an interview with Dr. Eric von Giesen, where he shows you the extent to which this program has progressed, and draw your own conclusions.
So that led me to the formation of two programs in my portfolio. One is the Epigenetic Characterization and Observation Program, or ECHO. And in ECHO, what we're doing is actually we're exploiting an entirely new landscape. It's a landscape that people have shied away from. We've known about the landscape, and that is the epigenome. And what's crazy about the epigenome is that it's kind of like a black box. It records what's happened in your life from day zero. And it even has little hints of recordings of what happened in your ancestors' life, because you can actually pass along the epigenome. Yeah, think about it like this. I mean, that's a great way to describe it. It's kind of a labeling system on your genome. Think of your genome as like your ACTGs, like you said, but it's about 2 meters long in every single cell. And it's also identical pretty much in every single cell, but it's used differently by every single cell. So the epigenome is really a way that each cell is able to know what parts of the genome to use, to live, to function. All the cells in our body function differently. The point here is that it's a pretty permanent mark, and it responds to the environment. When you go outside on a hot day, your epigenome is changing. When you go into, you know, an indoor pool where you breathe a lot of chlorine, that's changing your epigenome too. When you get a viral infection, it definitely is changing your epigenome, because your body is trying to respond to that virus by making antibodies. Guess how it makes those antibodies? It rewrites its own epigenome to make the antibodies that are very specific for that virus. And so what we can do is exploit that and say, oh, well, let's just look at the epigenome, because that response actually happens within an hour or so of exposure to a virus. So it's a quick response, and it's happening in millions of cells in your body. So there's plenty of cells to sample, therefore plenty of signal to read. So going back to my quest of reading what's going on in cells and in your body, this epigenome is a really ripe target for doing that in the context of viral infections. And it opens up a whole new landscape and way to diagnose infection that no one has been using ever. And so we're really the first ones doing it. When we started this program 2 years ago, no one thought we could do it. Now we're able to distinguish people who have infections better than the current state of the art. We're beating PCR, which is the current state of the art, polymerase chain reaction. And so we're beating that. But what's also cool is we're doing things that our current diagnostics can't do. For example, we're now in human samples distinguishing people who have drug-resistant infections from the same species of bacteria versus a non-drug-resistant strain of that bacteria. So this is like antibiotic resistance. We're diagnosing just from your own cells, your own epigenome, rather than taking a blood sample and having to culture that bacteria and figure out if it's responsive or non-responsive to antibiotics. We're able to show now from your own host response to those bacteria that we can tell you if you have a drug-resistant infection or not. And that can guide treatment. That can make a big difference. And we can detect it very early in the infection, much sooner than conventional methods. So that's the ECHO program in a nutshell. And we think we can actually change the game in COVID-19 response as well, because we think we're going to get responses days before the current technology for diagnosing or testing for that viral infection. So I think that's something that's very exciting for me, but hopefully it makes a difference in the world.
I hope you're connecting the dots. Imagine what is possible now. Not only the history, the lifetime line of any organism, for any organism has these epigenetic markers that are based on environmental events, experiences, also intervironmental or intravironmental events and experiences of your emotions, of your thoughts, of your energy exchange. Any organism has this. Not only can the lifetime line of an organism be read, but also predictions can be made into the future, into the behavior, into the impacts that will come towards this organism or this collective of organisms. Despite the gruesomeness of the idea of little robots crawling through our blood vessels and tissues, I believe that the last two developments, namely the discovery of the spatial epigenomic electrical pattern that determines shape, and secondly, the ability to read and predict the temporal epigenetic signatures that code an organism's history and memory, that these two developments are much more significant to understand in terms of our progress in nanotechnology. They go far deeper than technology has taken us before. They actually touch upon who we are as spatiotemporal beings, even touch upon who we are as created beings, created in the image and similitude of the divine. If that image, if that shape, if that energy field can be changed now by science, we have an obligation, a responsibility to take notice. Perhaps now we understand also why in the scripture it says that we were created in both an image, tselem, and a likeness or similitude, demut. They are not just two different words denoting the same idea. The image is the blueprint of life, the code for the body information. The similitude, on the other hand, is the field that is needed to enact or express this code. Without access to the right field, the body cannot be sustained in a higher function, or the DNA antenna cannot couple to the holographic memory to bring through more than the most basic molecular motions of life, to bring through that higher image component. We cannot allow this energy and information field needed for a higher evolutionary life to be overlaid or suffocated by a web of sensors, transmitters or modes and bods that seek to integrate all of life into the machine. that seek to subsume the biosphere into the technosphere, to use the terminology of Vladimir Vernadsky. Instead, we must remain true to sensitivity, to beauty, to honesty, and to true scientific inspiration, and open up a new layer of the noosphere to advance into that which is not of matter, but of light or of spirit. So what can we do? What can we learn from this decoding of the epigenetic field right at the moment of the biodigital convergence? First, we must treasure our own life, for we can write our own epigenome, and we cannot hand it over to the machine or to some university programming their minds into us. We can decide to stay in a higher energy field. And that also may include the necessity to remove interfering electromagnetic fields, such as Wi-Fi and cell phones, as much as possible. And we must actively seek exposure to, let me say, weapons of mass upliftment, namely to that which is positive, benign, and actively seek to bring kindness and peace and music and culture and real interaction with people of like minds. We must seek exposure to the higher life, that which is eternal, which is true, and which is ultimately powerful.